Okay, Apologetics 2, lecture number 12. We're talking about the apologetic methodology, i.e. the method of defending the faith, of Norman Geisler. Norman Geisler uses traditional apologetics. In other words, he does see neutral ground between the non-believer and the believer, where we can dialogue and argue for the truth of Christianity. We could also argue inductively for the truth of Christianity by adding more and more arguments and building a stronger and stronger case for Christianity. Geisler is a Thomist. He follows much of the reasoning and the philosophical and apologetic work of Thomas Aquinas. In fact, he follows him a lot closer than William Lane Craig or J.P. Moreland do. I would consider myself a Thomist if all you mean by Thomist is a traditional apologist. But if my epistemology, my theory of knowledge, had to be identical to Aquinas to be a Thomist, then I would not be a Thomist, because I don't believe he started life as a blank slate like Aquinas did. Geisler would be a much stricter Thomist. His main apologetic works, he's got tons of stuff, but the three I would list would be his Christian apologetics, and by the way, the lecture is just a summary of that. He just, his apologetic methodology, his apologetic system is just spelled out step by step in his book, Christian Apologetics. He also co-authored with Winfried Cordouan, Philosophy of Religion, where he goes over lots of different arguments for God's existence. That's probably the best textbook on that subject that's in print. And then he also has a work, When Skeptics Ask, not to be confused with When Critics Ask, which is more of a Bible difficulty type book. Geisler and Brooks authored When Skeptics Ask, and that's his most simplistic work on apologetics done. So he really tried to break it down to the level of a Christian layman there. First point I need to make right now is that Geisler is one of the few traditional apologists who has taken some of the presuppositional objections to heart. Now, that doesn't mean that he's abandoned traditional apologetics. He has not abandoned traditional apologetics. He's still using the traditional arguments for God's existence. But what he has done is he's fine-tuned traditional apologetics. He's recognized that the presuppositionalists were right, that we do have our own biases and our presuppositions, and we have to recognize that when we go into our defending the faith, and at the outset recognize that we might have to tear down the views of others to pave the way for our traditional apologetics to start. Geisler's book is separated, his book on Christian apologetics, into three sections. I wish I brought the book with me so that I could show you and just pass it around and stuff. And the first section is the most complex. It lays out the philosophical groundwork for the rest of the book. Because of that, most people who read or who attempt to read this book they get about halfway through the first one-third of it and they just give up on it. Even to the point where Geisler told me, when I met him face-to-face in Seattle, he told me that if he had to do it all over again, he would have put that first section last. And I told him, no, you did what you should have done. You put it right where it belongs. Because, see, the whole first question is a question of methodology. What method should we use to find truth? How do we answer this? The whole first section is an attempt to answer the question, how does man find truth? So that needs to be the base, the foundation for our arguing for Christianity. Now, by the way, I will say this, though, too. I think Geisler would be in total agreement with because Geisler lays out a logical system from point A, you know, part one, methodology, how do we find truth? Then once he comes up with a way to test worldviews, and part two is theistic apologetics, what is the true worldview? And he argues that theism is the true worldview. And then part three, he uses Christian apologetics and historical apologetics and argues which theistic religion is true. Because there's three theistic religions. There's Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. And so Geisler has this one book is really just one extended argument for the truth of Christianity. But if Geisler was here, I'm sure he would say that though he would like his students to master that book and to master his argument, at the same time, you don't need to discuss how, if you're witnessing to a Muslim, would you need to discuss how we find truth? No, because the Muslim believes in absolute truth just like we do. You wouldn't have to argue which is the true worldview because they're also theists. They believe in a personal creator God, an infinite creator God. So you would start on part three with a Muslim, okay? And but you start where the person's at. If you've got 350 premises in your argument, and the guy that you're witnessing to has accepted 349, please don't start at premise number one, because if he dies of a heart attack on premise number 75, you're going to feel pretty bad about it, okay? So start with, there's one guy I was talking to that was on a ferry and was arguing with a Muslim the whole way, a Muslim that it was a one-time thing, he was never going to see the guy again, as far as he knew. And he was arguing for God's existence to this Muslim, which is like, I'm trying to think of a good illustration. All the illustrations I'm getting in my head are weird ones.
That's kind of too long to make into an algebra.
Yeah, or trying to prove that 1 + 1 = 2 to a math professor. You know, if it's something, of course, there's some weird math professors that probably would need you to prove that to them. But, that's already agreed upon. That's like I debated a guy, the first debate I ever had back in, I don't know, 86, 87. And I did not, he was a Catholic who I was debating, and I did not argue, I did not give any evidence for the Bible being God's Word. Because this guy agreed with me that the Bible was God's Word. So I was refuting his views from the Bible. And at the end of the debate, another pastor told me that the only thing I could have done better, I should have provided evidence that the Bible was God's Word. And I said, no, when you're in a debate with someone, you take what they give you. If he'll give you any of your premises, then you don't need to argue for it. And so then you begin there. And argue for, you know, and you go right for the jugular vein.
More time to have a strong argument.
Yeah. Yeah. Why spend my time in a debate talking about stuff that we agree on? Okay, that's a given. But Geisler section number one, methodology: how do we find truth? In other words, the whole question he's trying to answer is: there are different worldviews. Which worldview? Okay. Which philosophy of life, which worldview, which view of the world is true? How do we test these worldviews? And so he tries to come up with a test in part one, methodology, how do we find truth? Once he comes up with this test, in part two on theistic apologetics, he takes this test, this method of finding which worldview is true, and he applies it to the different worldviews. And then he finds out that theism is true. Okay? And then in part three, he says there's three main theistic religions: Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Now, which one of these is true? And then he argues from history that Christianity is true. Now, by the way, Geisler is not pretending like René Descartes that he's going to throw away all his beliefs and doubt everything and only accept what he can know with logical necessity. Geisler knows that he's got his presuppositions. So Geisler's traditional apologetics is a lot like Schaefer, though it's more consistent than Schaefer was. He's got his worldview and he's going to put it to the test. And he's good, but he's going to put your worldview to the test as well and determine which worldview is true. So I don't see much difference between Geisler or Schaefer on this point, though Schaefer isn't always consistent with it because of his Vantillian influence. And Schaefer's argumentation isn't as rationally strong, though I find Schaefer's argumentation much more existentially gripping. In other words, I think Schaefer really works on the heart of a person more than Geisler does, but Geisler does a much better job working on the head of a person. Okay? But Geisler's Christian apologetics, that textbook, so that has his argumentation. So we'll look at section number one of his book, Methodology, How Do We Find Truth? And he lists, each one of his chapters is a different possible answer to the question, how do we find truth? The first answer would be agnosticism. Agnosticism says, well, you can't. There's no way to find truth. Man cannot know. Man cannot know truth, okay? Now, Geisler, and his argumentation is a lot more in-depth than what I'm just giving an overview. So sometimes we'll list 14 reasons why agnosticism fails. We're only going to get one tonight, okay? And it's going to be the same as we go throughout. So this is just a taste of Geisler's apologetics, an overview. You want to get deeper into it, you'll have to read his textbook. But agnosticism, the view that man cannot know, agnosticism fails as a test for truth because when an agnostic says man cannot know, he's claiming to know something. See, an agnostic says man cannot know anything. Well, if that statement is true, then that man knew one thing at least, and that is that man cannot know anything, so it's self-refused. The claim that man cannot know truth is a claim to know one truth, that man cannot know truth, and so it's self-refused. It cannot be true, okay? Next, Geisler looks at pure rationalism. Pure rationalism is the belief that through reason alone, through right thinking alone, we could arrive at the true world view. Okay? But Geisler argues that, so it's through pure reason at all, just through the mind alone. You don't even have to examine sense data, like that chair and the table and the physical universe and that type of thing. Just through the mind alone, pure rationalism. Well, Geisler argues that pure rationalism fails because pure rationalism can only prove what is false. It doesn't prove what is true. Now, what he's saying is, if something contradicts itself, if it's a contradiction, we know it's false. But if there's a worldview that doesn't contradict itself, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Okay? If we say, John stands 3 feet tall, but in the same way and at the same time he stands 10 feet tall, that's a contradiction. That's obviously false. Okay? But if we say that John stands 5'8" and he has yellow skin, that's not a contradiction. But through reason alone, we can't know if it's true. We have to go into sense data, and we have to look at it. We have to measure John and say, yeah, he's 5'8", but I look at him, he doesn't have yellow skin. But there, through reason alone, if it isn't contradictory, it doesn't tell us if it's true, but if it contradicts itself, it tells us that it's false. Also, pure rationalism, another reason why it fails, you can't prove everything through reason. Because if you could prove everything through reason, then your first principles, the first principles of reason, like the law of non-contradiction, if you could prove everything through reason, then you'd have to prove your first principles, your first premises, the first premises of your argument, you'd have to prove them true. But the problem is, if you had to prove them true, then they wouldn't be your first premises. The premises that prove them would be your first premises. But if you could prove everything through reason, you would have to prove them too. So they wouldn't be your first principles. You go on, an infinite regress, and you would have no first principles. So the first principles have to be assumed, presupposed, rather than rationally proven.
How does the Thomist like Geisler say that and yet hold to the Thomistic view that man is born on a slate without any of these first principles? Words.
Well, actually, pure rationalists would argue we're not born as a blank slate.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. Yeah. I'm saying that as a Thomist, Geisler would agree that man is born as a blank slate. Where do these first principles come from?
The first principles, he would just argue that they're basically good, solid things that we don't know with logical necessity, i.e. can't prove them through pure reason.
Right.
At the same time, Geisler would argue, and we're getting a little ahead of ourselves now, but Geisler would argue that they're actually undeniable or existentially undeniable. We'll see when we get to that point. And it's not logical necessity, but it's as close to it as you could want to get. And if you're going to deny it, if you're going to deny it, you're not going to be able to live consistent with it. But the Thomists would argue, and I'm not even a Thomist, and I would argue for my first principles the same way, that they're either self-evident truths, we just know they're true but we can't prove them, because they're the first principles, you can't go any further than, or that we know that they're true beyond all reasonable doubt, or the denial of these first premises is forced and temporary, such as, you know, a guy who says that there is no such thing as right and wrong, that's forced and temporary. He says it when he lectures in a philosophy hall. But then when he goes home and he gets mugged on the way home, he calls the cops and he wants justice. But, you know, he just got done saying there's no such thing as right and wrong. So there is no such thing as justice. But he makes moral value judgments. And Geisler would argue that they're actually undeniable. That even to deny the first principles, you have to affirm them while you're denying them. For instance, to say that the law of non-contradiction says A cannot equal non-A at the same time and in the same way. Okay? An example would be that either God exists or God does not exist. You can't say that they're both true. Okay? In the same way at the same time. There's no way that you could say that they're both true. But to deny the law of non-contradiction, to say that that doesn't hold, you have to, just to make any kind of a statement, just to communicate, you have to assume the law of non-contradiction does hold. Because if you're saying A, and in this sense A represents the law of non-contradiction, is not true, then what you're saying is non-A is false, which would be the law of non-contradiction is true, whereas the A would be the law of non-contradiction is not true. Okay? So you're just to communicate, you have to assume that. And anyway, pure rationalism fails. So maybe fideism is the way we should go. Fideism, you just believe something, you don't test it. So it doesn't even test truth claims, it just believes. However, guys are saying there, what they're doing is they're assuming... In order to deny the law of non-contradiction, to deny that reason, you have to hold that the law of non-contradiction isn't true, but you have to assume it in order to deny it. So fideism is contradictory and it has to be false as well. Then Geisler says, well, what about experientialism? Experientialism, in other words, you don't prove things, you just experience it. And if you experienced it, you know it must be true. So this is the way an existentialist would argue, through experientialism. A lot of your existentialist theologians, like Karl Barth, when you would have your encounter with God, your existential encounter, an experience with God, it goes beyond reason. You can't explain it in rational words. Okay? Geisler argues that, number one, no experience is self-interpreting. In other words, it'd be like if I walked up to John okay, an experience. I walk up to John, and I just walk up to him, and I hug him. Okay? That hug alone does not interpret itself. It doesn't come with its own built-in interpretation. Okay? John recognizes, oh, this is Phil, my pastor. He loves me with the love of the Lord, and so he's hugging me. So I'm interpreting this as a sign of friendship. However, if some thug off the, or some total stranger walks up to John and walks up to him and holds out his arms getting ready to hug him, that hug doesn't come with its own built-in interpretation. John might say, well, I don't know this guy, and I'm going to interpret it differently than a hug from Phil Fernandez. I'm interpreting this as a threat to my safety. And so John plants his right foot, clenches his right fist, and lets fly a knuckle sandwich. But the hug in itself, I should word it this way. If I hug John, he interprets it one way, but if I hug a stranger, he interprets it totally different. But the fact that something happened, in other words, he's conceding a point to the presuppositionalist here. Facts do not come with their own built-in interpretation. Experiences don't come with their own built-in interpretation. Instead, we look at isolated facts and we judge our experiences by our presupposed worldview or by some worldview. Okay? So you see what he's admitting? If you prove that Jesus rose from the dead, to an atheist who refuses to surrender his atheism, if you proved it to him to the point where he couldn't deny it, he would just say, okay, there's some natural law out there we haven't discovered yet that every 2,000 years somebody rises from the dead, and sometimes we find out about him, sometimes we don't.
But
But the key there is that our experiences are not self-interpreting. We interpret our experiences and facts by the worldview that we have. Now, being a traditional apologist, I think Geiser would agree with me that eventually the facts can be stacked so high against your worldview that eventually you surrender your worldview and accept another one that explains things better. Whereas the presuppositionalist will often imply that would never happen apart from the Holy Spirit regenerating you. And conflicting truth claims based on experience cannot be tested, so experientialism fails. In other words, supposing John says, I experienced God, and he's 3'7" and weighs 400 pounds. This is a real stocky God. And then I say, no, wait a minute, John, I experienced God, and he's 10 feet tall, but he only weighs 9 pounds. If experience is our only test for truth, we have no way for me to judge whether his is false and for him to judge whether mine is false or whether mine is true. See, because experience is the final court of appeals. So you need something above experience to test to test the experiences by.
And besides, everybody's had experience that they're claiming false, mirages, dizziness, vertigo.
Yep. And see, and the thing is, too, is the Buddhist and the Hindu is going to argue along these lines that I have experienced God. I can't put it into words. You can't know the truth with the mind. You can only experience it, and I just can't put it into words. And they just accept it as experience alone. So they can even say contradictory things, and it's like they could care less. And but in actuality, they cannot live consistent with that view. Evidentialism also fails. Evidentialism is you look for evidence in history to try to find which is the true worldview. But again, facts don't come with their own built-in interpretation. A resurrection of a carpenter from Nazareth, the resurrection of him from the dead 2,000 years ago in a theistic worldview tells us something about that guy who rose from the dead. Tells us that God put a stamp of approval on him. What was his message? And then we find out when he claimed to be God and Savior, then that settles the issue. But if you're an atheist or a pantheist, even if somebody could prove to you that Jesus did rise from the dead, they would just add an extra footnote to their atheistic worldview or their pantheistic worldview and give a different interpretation to it. So we interpret facts by our worldviews and not the other way around, for the most part. But eventually enough facts might shake us from our worldview. So evidentialism failed. Now, Geisler is not saying that John Warwick Montgomery is wrong for using historical evidences to prove Christianity. What he's saying is John Warwick Montgomery is wrong to use historical evidences alone. Okay? John Warwick Montgomery needs to debate with the atheist on the worldview issue before you even get to the historical evidences. Okay? And I don't even think Geisler would be saying, therefore, Montgomery has to write books on arguments for God's existence. But what he should do is he should let people know, this is assuming that the people we're arguing with already do believe in the existence of the theistic God. Okay? Which Montgomery hasn't done as far as I know. So evidentialism fails to be a test for truth. Pragmatism. Now, pragmatism is the test that says if something works, it must be true. That's the pragmatic test. If it works, it's true. Okay? Well, it's true that all truth must ultimately work, but not everything that works is necessarily true. Okay? In other words, Christianity ultimately works. Since Christianity is true, I will spend eternity with Jesus. Okay? Because I am trusting in Him for salvation. So Christianity ultimately works. At the same time, because I'm a Christian, if they reinstate persecution of Christians, it might not look like it's working too good if people start hitting me with clubs and throwing me in dungeons and whipping me and that type of thing. But ultimately, if it's true, it's going to work. At the same time, we might not see we can't always see the long-range results. And another thing that we need to note is that lies often work. For instance, the doctor, I think Geisler points this out too, a doctor might say, hey, you know, I'm operating on Joe Schmo, and I've done these operations before, and Joe Schmo has about a 10% chance of making it. But if I tell him he's got a 10% chance of making it, he's got about a 2% chance of making it. So I'm going to tell him he's got a 99% chance of making it, which means he'll have that full 10% chance. So the doctor lies. So the guy goes in there thinking, yeah, this is going to work. It's a piece of cake, tells his wife, piece of cake, honey. This guy does it all the time, 99% chance of making it. And then he pulls through. So the lie worked. It encouraged the guy. Yeah, that's what they thought, first aid.
Tell me you're okay.
You got a guy whose legs were blown off in combat or something, and the first thing the guy says, how am I going to do? And the first thing he says, pat him on the head and say, don't worry, you're going to be fine. Help is on the way. You're looking good. Just relax. And deep down inside, you're thinking to yourself, come on, with all the blood this guy lost, I'm surprised he's got any blood left. I thought he would have been dead 10 minutes ago. But you don't tell the person the truth in those cases. In those cases, your number one thing is to keep them from going into shock, which is more like the number one killer. And so you reassure them, even if you have to make up a few stories there. So lies, what's that? Yeah, I don't want to get into Geisler's view on ethics and stuff, but I agree with him on the greater good ethic, that if two of God's commands come in conflict where you can't obey both, you cannot obey both, then you have to figure which command is greater, and then you obey the greater command, and God gives you an exemption from obeying the lesser command. So you do the greater good. Rahab the harlot lied and refused to submit to the governing authorities when she told the Canaanite, the Jericho leaders, that the two spies had, the Israelite godly spies, had left the other way. And when they went after them, then she let them down from her roof. And God compliments her for that lie. Also, the Egyptian midwives who were supposed to kill every male Israelite that was born, they lied too. And said, oh no, before we even get there, these Israelite ladies are having their babies, so it's not our fault. Well, they lied through their teeth. God compliments them as well. So if somebody holds a gun to your head and says, where's your wife? I want to go shoot her. If you know she's in the bedroom, you better lie through your teeth. Say, well, she went to the 7-Eleven down the block, and if you go right now, you could probably catch her. And what do you suppose? I agree with Geisler on that point as well. But lies often do work. Generals have to do it all the time. You have to, number one, lie about what your troops are going to do so that the enemy is deceived. But then you often have to lie to your troops. You have to say, man, we are going to get whooped. There's 5,000 of them and 1,000 of us. I don't know if we're going to make it, but we got a good plan. Let me pick up the confidence of my troops and just tell them, you know, hey, I've done this type of thing before. We got it. No problem. And so Custer told his men, Little Big Horn was going to be a piece of cake. Lies often work. Sometimes they don't. So pragmatism fails. All pragmatism tells us basically is what works. It doesn't tell us whether just because it worked, it automatically was true. Okay? A guy might become a black Muslim. A guy might go to prison like Malcolm X, accept the black Muslim faith, and that might reform his life. So no longer is he a lawbreaker and a thug, even though his message was pretty radical. But all of a sudden, now this guy is a law-abiding citizen. So Malcolm X is, to a certain degree, his Muslim faith worked for him. But it didn't work to the point where it was going to give him eternal life. That only comes through Jesus. So we need, just because something works doesn't mean it's true. Geisler also argues that combinationalism fails. What this is okay, well, this let's say experientialism was weak and pure rationalism was weak and evidentialism was weak and pragmatism was weak, but let's start adding all of these leaky buckets together. And Geisler says that fails because if you add leaky buckets together, you will still not be able to hold water. Adding inadequate solutions does not give us an adequate solution. Okay? So is there an adequate test for truth? Geisler says there is. And it sounds a lot like combinationalism, but there's a twist on there. And that twist is an ever-important twist. Geisler says the adequate test for truth are the following. Number one, unaffirmability. Unaffirmability means basically if a view is contradictory, it is false. So unaffirmability, we take pure rationalism basically and we say, yes, we can use that to prove if worldviews are false, or we can prove that a worldview is false if it's contradictory. It's unaffirmable, okay? Agnosticism is unaffirmable. To say man cannot know. Man cannot know truth. Well, that's a claim to know, that man cannot know truth. It self-refutes, okay? So if something is unaffirmable, it must be false. But that only tells us the falsity. How do we test for the truth of a worldview? Geisler then says, we need to argue along the lines of actual undeniability. Now, this is not logical necessity. Logical necessity means that its opposite must be false, must logically be false, therefore it has to be true in the fullest rational sense. Actual undeniability does not say that. Actual undeniability is recognizing that through logical necessity we can learn a lot of mathematics, but it doesn't really tell us anything about the real world. But actual undeniability, it's you can call it also existential undeniability. What it is it's saying that my existence, and this, by the way, is Geisler's first premise when he argues for theism. My existence, okay, Phil Francis, my existence is not logically necessary. Okay? It's not a contradiction in pure reason alone to say Phil Francis doesn't exist. Okay, that would not be a logical contradiction. To say a square is a circle, that's a logical contradiction. Okay? But to say Phil France does not exist, that's not a logical contradiction. Okay? However, if Phil Fernandez stands up and says, I do not exist, I'm uttering an unaffirmable statement. In other words, I'm affirming my existence in order to make the denial of my existence. In other words, I have to, nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. So for me to deny my own existence, I have to do what first in order to make, I have to exist in order to make the denial. Yeah, so it is actually, there are certain things that are actually undeniable, and that should be used as the test of a worldview. And once we get the worldview, the true worldview, by finding out which worldviews are unaffirmable, which ones contradict themselves, and then finding out, is there any worldview that's actually undeniable? If we find the actually undeniable worldview, to say something's actually undeniable, you're saying it's well beyond all reasonable doubt. It's almost self-evidently true. The opposite of it is the denial of it is forced and temporary. You contradict yourself in the denial. To deny it is self-contradictory. So you're getting about as close to logical necessity as you can get. At the same time, you're recognizing that you need more than pure reason to find truth. So Geisler says, so we use these tests. If a worldview is unaffirmable, then it's false, and if it's actually undeniable, then it's true. Now, once we find the true worldview, which for Geisler and for myself, I think he makes a great case for theism being the one true worldview, theism, the existence of an infinite personal creator God, who is separate from his creation, but is still involved with his creation. His creation depends upon him. Once you find the true worldview through unaffirmability and actual undeniability, then you can apply the combinationalism, the systematic coherence, as a test for the truth statements within a worldview. In other words, once you prove that theism is the true worldview, it's actually undeniable, then you could say, okay, now we've got three main theistic worldviews, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And any other theistic worldview pretty much is a corruption of one of those three. So now the question comes up, how do we test those? And so systematic coherence is a test for truth statements within a worldview. Consistency. The statements that these worldviews come up with that separate, you know, what statements do the Muslims make that Christians don't make? Are those statements contradictory or not? And if they do contradict themselves, then that's not the true theistic worldview. Consistency, it must be non-contradictory. It must have empirical adequacy. In other words, it must explain all the relevant facts. If you say, well, if you have a worldview, for instance, that doesn't have any basis, any explanation for moral value judgments, then you have no right to call the actions of Adolf Hitler evil. But if you do call Adolf Hitler evil, then you need a new worldview, because atheism is not empirically adequate, because it isn't explaining all the relevant facts, such as morality. And it must have experiential relevance. It must be livable. Okay? Any worldview that says that the physical world doesn't exist, it's an illusion, like your Hindus. Let's face it, if this guy doesn't put some food in his mouth and drink a little bit of water each day, the guy's going to be a dead man real quick. That's not a livable worldview. And so a guy can deny the existence of the physical world when he gives a philosophy lecture, but he can't live it. He has to live like the physical world does exist. So these are the tests that Geisler used to test the truth. Now, his unaffirmability and actual undeniability, he tests in section number 2 when he goes over the different worldviews. The different worldviews, And then in section number three, he uses systematic coherence, and he tests the theistic worldviews after he proves theism to be the true worldview. So number two, his theistic apologetics, the second section of his book, What is the True Worldview? First off, he argues that deism fails. Deism is the belief that Thomas Jefferson held to it. God created the universe, but then he left it alone. He doesn't perform miracles, doesn't communicate to man. He just split, created the universe, and then left. Deism fails because if God created the world, he is both able and willing to intervene in the world. If he was willing to create it, you would think he would want to communicate with us in some way. You would think, and he would obviously be able to communicate with us and to intervene, and you would also think that he'd be willing to. So it's a view that is problematic, to say the least. And I'm whitewashing over Geisler's argumentation here. Again, this is just an overview. Pantheism. Pantheism is the view that God is the universe. Rather than God created the universe like Christianity we hold to, it's the view that God is the universe. Well, this fails to explain the existence of a finite self. You know, why would one finite, why would one limited being be arguing with another limited being that we're all the same being and the distinction between the two of us isn't real? Well, why would you try to convince me of that since you are me and I am you? So it fails to explain the existence of the finite self. It fails to explain the existence of evil. Even evil is an illusion. Yet, you look at all the pantheists that are out there that are protesting nuclear war, protesting the damage that's supposedly being done to the environment. If pantheism is true, if God is the universe, then everything is right by definition because God is everything. So all distinction is blurred. The distinction between me and you is blurred, but the distinction between right and wrong is blurred as well. Also, if God is unknowable, the pantheist claims God is unknowable. He transcends human thought. If God is unknowable, how could we know that pantheism is true? If we can't know anything about God, we wouldn't be able to know that pantheism is true because pantheism is a claim to know something about God. So it's unaffirmable. Panentheism fails. Panentheism, God is both limited, he's finite, but he's also unlimited. He's also infinite. Kind of the universe is God's body. Panentheism fails because a finite, changing God, basically, if any part of God's essence is finite, limited, and changing, then even this limited, changing God needs an unlimited, non-changing God to ground its existence. And we're going to see when Geisler argues for that, when he argues for theism. But basically, the panentheist God is too small. The panentheist God would not be able to exist on its own. It would need the theistic God to cause it to exist, if it did exist, which it doesn't. It's a fairy tale God. And then Geisler argues that atheism, the view that there is no God, atheism fails. Number one, the arguments are invalid and self-refuting. No, and we're going to cover that, the failure of atheistic arguments, after we get through Geisler, which won't be in this lecture. But after we get through Geisler, we'll start arguing about the failure of atheistic arguments, spend a couple lectures on that. But atheism fails, the arguments are invalid and self-refuting, we'll deal with that later. If atheism is true, there's no explanation for the existence of the universe, for the personality of man, and for the moral judgments that we make. Yet atheists live as if there's an explanation for the existence of the universe. They live as if we are really personal beings, and they live as if there are some things that are right and wrong. And so then Geisler argues on pages 238 and 239 of Christian Apologetics that theism is actually undeniable. Now, I listed that, forgot the book, so I listed down the premises in kind of in shorthand from my wife. I called her up and had her told her where the book is in my library. She located it and read the pages to me. I read the points to me. He's got a 10-point argument. This is his argument for that theism is actually undeniable. Every one of the premises flows from the premises before it, okay? So the conclusion flows from the premises, and the first premise is actually undeniable, therefore the conclusion is actually undeniable. This is what Geiser, how he argues. Point number one, some things, either something or some things, undeniably exist. And he argues for that by saying, I cannot deny my own existence. In other words, I have to actually exist in order to deny my own existence, therefore it is actually undeniable that I exist. Okay? Again, nothing is nothing, nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing is nothing, nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. If you exist, you have to exist in order to deny your own existence. So something undeniably exists. Then Geisler argues that my non-existence is possible. Now he shows that we depend on things to keep us in existence, like air, food, water. Therefore, it's possible if those things were taken away that I would not exist. Okay? Point number three, he argues, whatever has the possibility to not exist is currently being caused to exist by another. You know, I need water, I need food, I need oxygen to keep me in existence. Point number four, there cannot be an infinite regress of current causes of existence. If we keep going further and further back, you can't go infinitely back, because then there would be nothing to ground the current continuing existence of everything that exists that needs a cause. Point number five, therefore, a first uncaused cause of my current existence must exist and must ground the existence of all the limited things that exist.